Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. Hey, I just wanted to say this is a quick reminder. We're kicking off the new year, and that means there are sponsorship opportunities that are available for IPv6 Buzz and the other Packet Pushers podcast shows, too. So if you're interested, you can go to packetpushers.net/sponsorship for all the details. And if you have IPv6 support in your product and you want to be featured on the IPv6 Buzz, come talk to us. We'd love to hear about you and the product. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hogue, and today we're going to be talking about IPv6 only with our guest, Nick Baraglio. Today, we're going to sort of jump right in and start off with some sort of deep dive sort of questions about v6 only, because there's a bunch of stuff going on in the federal organizations. We'll talk about that really briefly here, maybe. But we want to talk about like v6 only as like the practical thing. So, Nick, welcome to the show. Why don't you talk us a little bit through maybe the high overview about why people are going to be interested in it, and then we'll get into the details about what's going to go on with getting a v6 only sort of thing rolled and deployed.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here and talk about this. So as some folks may know, there's a U.S. government mandate. It's a memo that was originally written in March of 2020 and then finalized or signed into, finalization in on November 19th of 2020. And what that does is it outlines the mandate to move all federal networks to IPv6 only.
Yeah, so this is for some folks, it's a really big deal, right? Because it's like, okay, finally, we have something that we can hang our hat on. Because there's been mandates in the past that have talked about, hey, you got to get some sort of v6 deployed, but they didn't have a lot of teeth in them, right? I think that was
It was easy to find loopholes,
right?
In the times it's been done before,
and they tighten it up, right?
Significantly. So as this is written, it's an easy read. If folks want to go take a look at it, it's not that long, and it's very.
We'll put the link in the show notes so folks can find it. That'll be easy.
Yeah, it's very easy to digest, and basically what it does is it breaks down the timeline, which is sort of one of the things that was missing from the last time this was written, and it also provides guidance on how to actually do it from an organizational level. So it'll give you, a date on the timeline that says you need to form a committee that, is focused on transitioning to IPv6 only. And it's got to be done by this date, and you have to be able to report it. And so prior to this one, that didn't really exist. It was kind of just, your web servers and your DNS servers have to have IPv6 addresses on them. And, a lot of times that's where things kind of just stopped.
Right. Okay. So impact wise, that means that every organization is going to have to figure out and have some sort of working group effectively that is starting to, noodle through these sets of guidelines and requests from this OMB.
Yes. And that date's already passed, actually. So it was 3 months from the date it was signed, which was November 19th. There was to be, I believe, if I'm remembering right, I don't have it in front of me, there needs to be a working group essentially dedicated to this by January 3rd. Okay. And maybe it was a little bit after that, but it was right around that time. But we're talking like department level, right? So like Department of Education, Department of whatever else,
Right.
I'm sure that's already happened. But the nice thing is that it's actually defined, outlined, and very clear when and what.
Yeah. And so given the fact that this stuff is going on sort of today and it's current, I think probably many folks are sort of scratching their head and going, well, what does that really mean? I mean, what's, and how does that impact an organization? What impact is it going to be? Typically we're talking with a lot of folks that sort of work in the enterprise IPv6 space, trying to figure that landscape out. But I have a feeling that this is sort of the, for folks that are in the federal space, there's a whole new set of opportunities of landscape around v6 now, because they're going to have to get some sort of v6 only operating within their environment, right? They're going to need to get some sort of pilot, proof of concept, lab, something built in order to prove that they can get some sort of v6, sort of working, right?
Yeah, and so a couple things. First, those things that you mentioned, pilots, labs, things like that, they're actually written into the mandate for the departments to actually spin those up. So,
okay,
you know, a big part of a major change like that is experimenting with it. And they've sort of laid out, like, here's how you do that. The second thing is that, you know, the government networks are one thing, and listeners may be thinking, well, you know, I'm not a government network, so I don't need to care about that. But if you start thinking about all of the things that you need to touch from a business standpoint, network wise, you're going to be working with the federal government. Your institution or your, you know, organization may provide services to that. So the other thing that's written into it is that there is a, I don't want to call it a mandate, but there's a suggestion that, you know, government institutions start right now working with their business partners to enable IPv6 only. And when we say that, that doesn't mean dual stack. Like dual, if they're just now doing dual stack, they're behind.
Right.
Right. That those days are past.
Yeah, I think it's important for folks to realize that if you're trying to sell to the federal government, you want to sell a piece of software that's going to operate in there, or you've got an actual network that has to interface, right? I think those are going to be the areas that are going to cause scramble for the rest of the sort of enterprise and commercial space, right? That might have a solution that needs to interface with. And that's a pretty broad and large audience.
Right? It really is.
Yeah, of folks that are selling to and supporting the federal government. So I think this will probably impact a lot more folks than anyone anticipates. I don't know, you know, I'm not as familiar in this landscape. I know Scott's spent a lot more time in his career working on the federal side. But for myself, I can see, like, anyone who's working in banking and finance, this is definitely going to impact you if you're probably dealing with, like, insurance and then definitely in software sales. I can see those as being all areas that are going to have high touch impact around being able to support IPv6 only. And I don't think there are a lot of as many software development companies and even networking companies that are really trying to do V6 only through and through, right? I don't know, Nick, if that's been your experience with sort of, like, not as much testing there, not as much compliance, probably not as much like, hey, this is something we should really be playing with and trying to figure it out.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. I think you're spot on with the finance and banking industries being very affected by this, because anyone that's got to deal with IRS systems is going to need to have V6. I think one important thing to note here is that the federal government networks are mandated to be IPv6 only. The connecting networks, or the networks that will need to interface with them, just need to have IPv6 support. Right, because you can't, or a translation mechanism of some kind. Ideally, they just, you know, put native IPv6 out.
Dual stack, right? If they're dual stack, they'll be able to talk to the federal
right,
government.
Right,
V6 only, right? So, yeah.
Yep, they don't need to be V6 only, but they need to have V6 transit support so that they can speak the same language. And I think that's an important distinction. No one is saying that your enterprise has to dump IPv4, but if you're going to need to talk to federal resources, you're going to have to support IPv6 in one way or another.
Right. But I think the challenge is, if you want to sell something that the federal government is then going to operate or utilize out of you, it's going to need to, and they're running it on their own, it's going to need to support V6 only, which means they're going to have a setup to be able to support Valley
right.
to confirm that it can do V6 only, right? That's the sort of nuanced detail here. So if you're building a software product and the federal government wants to buy it because they want to use it within whatever institution it is, it needs to run on a V6 only network, right?
Yep, and that's something that is sort of emerging right now. So there's V6. What any of us that have touched V6 in ever are going to quickly say is that the quote-unquote V6 support means different things to different people. I mean, it's almost as interpretable as SDN was 10 years ago, right?
And still is.
Yeah, V6 support just means to some that I can turn on IPv6, I can listen for a router advertisement, and I can configure a Slack address that then gets me transit over the V6 net internet. That, you know, at its most basic, that's kind of where it sits. But you know, there's that, there's quote unquote V6 support, and then there's running an IPv6 only, and those are really different experiences.
Yeah, I know there's a whole set talking in the past, we've had some folks from LinkedIn as guests in the past, and just talking about some of the challenges of just doing bare metal bootstrapping. for resources, servers, you know, anything else that might you want to do zero touch provisioning around. V6 has a whole different set of challenges versus what we traditionally do with V4. And I think many institutions are going to find that maybe there's some gaps and some areas of improvement that need to happen. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity for a lot of the industry to be able to start testing and figuring this out. And this mandate really helps to sort of push that ball forward, or maybe a little further up the hill, in terms of getting, you know, better V6 only related support into products and services that you know, the federal government's gonna want to be able to use. Because, you know, there's a handful of individuals who have really, you know, flown the flag on V6 only for a while, but I think this is going to significantly change the landscape. So maybe we can talk a little bit about maybe some of those details of around V6 and maybe some of the details around what you think are some of the immediate technical challenges that folks are going to find on the V6 only side.
Oh, for sure. So I think there's a couple of different things we can go down here. Building a V6 only quote network. So like when I say network, I mean like a service provider backbone or a core network of an institution, like a campus or an enterprise. That's fairly straightforward. You know, that's mostly a solved problem. There's some, you know, nuances in protocols and things like that. And I think that's sort of a harbinger of what you'll find across the entire spectrum of IT, right? There's the differing levels of support, but it's always the little fringe details that are starting to come up now that need to be addressed. So for example, you've got, let's say, a PDU, like a power distribution unit in a remote POP or in a remote closet or whatever, and you want to run IPv6 only on that. This is where we go back to the, you know, the IPv6 support label. What does that mean? Does that mean I can turn that on? I can assign it a static IPv4 address and I can disable IPv4 completely? No, it probably doesn't mean that. It probably means that I can enable IPv6. There is an expectation that there's also IPv4. I can maybe only get a Slack address. And if I'm really lucky, I can disable any security extensions for rotating the auto-generated addresses. And so that can be problematic from the perspective of, you know, management of these critical systems, right? You have to be able to have a known quantity. You need to know how to get to that device, and it needs to never change. And so those are the strange little things that that will start to crop up as people go through and start disabling IPv4. And you guys have got some great historical podcasts on, you know, if you turn off V4, here's the, you know, I'm going to complain because all of my checking code for quote internet access or network access is based around IPv4, but I operate just fine. You know, I'll just complain about not having access, even though I do.
I just was going to ask, just coming from a vendor background that was very much adjacent to a lot of networks in the federal space that were trying to get to IPv6 in some measure. Not obviously, this predates the IPv6 only mandate, but you know, there was always that tension of what IPv6 support meant to different customers, and I wondered, do you have any sense of the vendors now that are, you know, that are really pushing to support IPv6, you know, is there some sense of like a truth test in terms of whether or not they're going to be able to support IPv6 only environments? Is this like a potential moment of panic for a lot of vendors to be like, well, we've really done a lot of hand waving around IPv6 to make sure that it mostly works in the data plane and works, you know, kind of okay in the control plane, but, you know, getting to a true IPv6 only environment, oh crap, we're really behind the eight ball on this. Because when we're talking about the mandate, like what is 80% by 2025 in federal networks for IPv6 only support? Yeah. So what's your sense of where the vendors are at?
So my experience has been across a very wide spectrum of platforms has been that it's mostly there. There's little things that don't work, And for the most part, if you're willing to work with vendors and maybe help them out, you know, if you have a lab or if you're willing to sort of test things for them, probably not in production, obviously, but maybe, you know, depends on how, you know, how much of a cowboy you want to be, but they're willing to sort of fix these little things. Because like I said, like it's, I would say it's probably 80% there on the hardware stack. You know, like the network equipment vendors, for some, it's all the way there. But there's little things like, you know, LDPv6, right? If you're building a carrier backbone and you need it to be IPv6 only, it's probably going to be MPLS, at least right now. It may be moving to segment routing or something else. But if you're still using a label distribution protocol for your, you know, your label switch pass, your LSPs, you know, you need to be able to support LDPv6. You know, it's those type of things that maybe need a little more stick time, a little more, you know, battle hardening.
Right.
But as far as those things go, I think it's a lot closer than people think it is. It may not be perfect, but it's pretty close.
I just remember I think I would tend to agree related to, again, the data plane and everything related to getting the core up and running and passing V6 packets. But I just remember going to various V6 conferences, you know, through the last decade or so. And I remember there was always that moment of terror for vendors when Ron Brersma from DRAN would get up with a big grid of all the support that wasn't there for various, you know, aspects of V6 in a particular product. And it was always really more related to even close to 10 years ago, it was related to more management functions, things that, you know, running the management of a network over V6 versus just delivering V6 packets. And so that's where I'm just kind of really wondering, you know, it's one thing to be like, okay, we know we have dual stack to fall back on. And if I have to just continue to manage the network over IPv4, that's fine. But in a scenario where it's like, oh, all of a sudden, you know, in the next 4 years, I've got to have 80% of my network, you know, maybe I'm just banking on that 20% being the management plane of the network that's just going to continue to trudge along on V4. But I sort of really wonder where a lot of vendors will end up in terms of management support for IPv6 only, as opposed to, you know, hey, I know I can take this packet in on V6 packet in on an interface and send it out another interface without any problem. So, hey, I'm V6 only.
So I can speak to that directly. And so, but first of all, I want to say, I really miss seeing Ron's talks.
Absolutely.
I haven't spoken to him in quite some time, but he used to always speak at the educational conference that was called Joint Techs, that it was real big in the R&E world that I would go to, that has kind of since dissolved and turned into something different. And I haven't seen him since then, but I always enjoyed his talks because they were very straightforward. And I mean, let's be honest, they're fairly blunt about, you know, fix your stuff.
Naming and shaming, like baby. That.
Yes. Yeah. It was blunt. It was brutal.
it was brutal. But, you know, somebody has to play that part. But from the perspective of a management network, I've done this. And I've done this at a national scale. It is possible to do. And it does take a fair bit of work. It took a fair bit of work to work with the vendors to, I guess, meet the expectations that we had, you know, in doing this. So, you know, it's the little things. It's the embedded systems. It's the I don't want to call them esoteric, but they're, you know, less familiar systems like optical platforms, you know, where you're running DWDM, the control plane of those is, it's really a specialty router, for lack of a better way to describe it, you know, an optical shelf that runs your DWDM platform across a country or an ocean or whatever, has these management channels, and they run in most cases OSPF-TE, which is it's a specialty set of protocol extensions and, you know, maybe GMPLS. And those are often, OSPFT has historically just been IPv4, right? Because it's OSPFv2 that's been modified. So those things where you want to run management of these very low level, yet incredibly important systems, you know, maybe V4 only, that's even changed. So there's been inclusion of the V6 stack and in the ability to run as V6 only on these, you know, I want to call them fringe, but to me they're not, but to most people they, you know, there's not a lot of people that get to touch that kind of equipment. So they may just not even know it exists in some cases. But those are the little things that you have to think about when you're doing V6 only. And that's mostly working at this point. And so the, you know, and this is all management side, right? This isn't data plane. This is 100% management plane of a network and control plane, you know, to support that management plane. So you can run that. You can run your out of band networks as V6 only, depending on how you plumb them. The equipment, there's equipment out there that will operate with no V4 on it for that respect, for getting to consoles and IPMI interfaces. And then the equipment that has to connect all that stuff together, you know, like your standard layer 2 switches, you can run those as V6 only too. So it is actually doable. And I can say empirically because I've done it.
Well, and maybe if we pivot back really quickly, because one of the areas that I'm interested in sort of chatting through is really a bit of roadmap around the technical details. So like MPLS with LDP, right? There's sort of this campsite of like, are you going to go segment routing? Are you going to, like what's the direction going to be? And the support isn't universal across all the manufacturers in terms of where their heads are at, right? So this is one of the of like, if you got, mixed environment, you got, Arista, Juniper, Cisco, whatever else, Extreme, right? You're not going to get something consistent in terms of supportability across all the platforms in the same way that you can in V4 today, or at least that's my belief. And maybe we can talk through that a bit, because that is going to impact how you make decisions within your organization from a technical detail basis around, hey, we've got MPLS, that's how we're built, designed, and deployed for V4. Do we make different decisions about control management plane based off of the product families that we have, or based off the product families we are going to, right? Like how is that working? Right? How did that work for you going through that process? And then how do you think people should be thinking about that going forward?
That's a very good distinction to point out there, because I think a lot of typical enterprises or campuses or whatever have the ability to be single vendor. Personally, in my 23, 24 years of building networks, I have never once worked on a single vendor network. So I'm admittedly very ignorant in this space. But I think that the interaction comes down to you have to decide on the least common denominator of, protocol stack support. So if you have, like you said, you've got a big multi-vendor network and this supports this and that supports that, you have to essentially do one of two things. You've got to minimize down to what the minimum level of support is across all of them, or you have to identify that one of the two or two of the three or whatever is a one-off and they're managed differently. Personally, I tend to go towards the first option there. Because I'm not a big fan of managing one-off things from an operational standpoint. But the multi-vendor thing it's very much like the early days where, pieces of the protocols were supported in one way or another, but not necessarily complete across the entire spectrum of equipment available.
Yeah, and I think there are issues that are going to happen for folks as they go through, let's say you're a larger enterprise and you have deployed MPLS, like, the decision-making process about how you're going to support going forward V6 in your design architecture, you need to sit down and have an architecture review meeting that really talk about where your vendor is at. If you want to go segment routing, that's pretty early in the code release time, right? Still from a manufacturer basis. So I think you're going to have some, here's where we're at now, here's where we need to go. And maybe for enterprise, it's not as big of a deal because the V6 only portion, you're like, okay, I can still run some stuff in V4 for control plane or some other items. But I think for those that are in the federal space, this is going to become maybe a more urgent issue of discussion with some of the manufacturers around what that roadmap is going to look like, what they're going to support, not support, and helping you make decisions about how you're going to get from where you're at today to V6 only. Because they don't have to have that turned on immediately, but they have to have a roadmap and they have to understand how they're going to get there. And they need commits, right, from those manufacturers about what they're going to support and what they aren't.
Yeah, I'm really hoping, and obviously all this is my personal opinion and whatever, but I'm really hoping that this is sort of a catalyst for jump-starting more mainstream IPv6 conversations, as well as getting it pushed down into places where it historically wouldn't have been. Because, I mean, as you guys have noted many times, you know, V6 is really all over the place already. Like, it's, you know, it's on every mobile handset. It's, you know, it's on sensor networks. It's, you know, cores of big ISPs have been dual stacked for, you know, in some cases 15 plus years. And it's really been limited in the spaces where you hear the, you know, you hear the, I don't want to call it an excuse, but the statement, well, no one's asking for it, right? Well, no one's ever really going to ask for it until now. They're going to have to start asking for it. So I'm hoping that this becomes a catalyst for really pushing it out and making it more visible and more deployable for the smaller organizations, or the organizations historically just sort of avoided it because it wasn't on fire.
Right. As far as the 2107 mandate goes, they just need to, by end of fiscal year 2023, turn off IPv4 on 20% of their assets. So they don't really need to boil the ocean in the near term. They just need to turn off V4 on 20%. So where do you think the 20% V4 is going to get turned off on?
That's the million-dollar question. Now, what I've seen and my experience has been is that backbones are the easiest to start with. And that's been true from the very beginning of my experience with IPv6, is that, you know, the backbones are the easiest part to just make V6. The end hosts are where everything starts to get, it devolves, the end hosts and the ancillary support systems. Now, the support systems are now, you know, you could do it at this point, right? My, you know, my HP LaserJet has V6. My APC UPS has V6. So the stacks are there. It's really just working out what do they do when you disable V4 or you give a V4 that goes nowhere. That's a little bit of a gray area to me too, is if you just don't configure it, but don't disable it, does that meet the mandate? I don't know. But I would start probably, if I was doing it from the ground up, I would start with the, you know, a handful of things that I have to touch every day. That way I can work the bugs out of what might come up that I'm not expecting. So maybe a jump host or, you know, a VDI system or something like that, where there's friendly users on it all the time and you can disable V4 and see how that goes. And then at the same time, have the network engineering folks looking at converting the backbone over to V6 only and pulling V4 out of it.
Yeah, because it's still an unfunded mandate. So if you, like Jennifer Aniston in your Office Space, you just wanted to wear 15 pieces of flair on your uniform, you know, you just wanted to do the minimum, you could find, you know, add up all the IP addresses that you've allocated and find that, you know, 20% where you could turn off V4. Maybe that's an IoT environment and there's a lot of devices. So that counts for a lot of addresses and that counts for your 20%. So they could V6 only a little isolated environment like that, count up the addresses and get to 20% and only do the minimum, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, and my guess is that given that everybody's doing more with less, that that's probably the way it will run, unless someone is very ambitious and mm-hmm. wants to say, we have the opportunity to do this all at once, so we'll do it. But I'm guessing that, you know, it'll be a controlled burn, you know, of we'll do the 20% and it'll be this thing right here and it'll be this enclave and we'll see how it goes and then move on to the next part of the mandate. Because like we talked about earlier, it's got a nice timeline to it. And, you know, the thing about having a timeline is you know what's expected and by when. And I think that's the real win of this particular memo, is that there's not a lot of wiggle room. And they learned from the last time they wrote this to leave that not interpretable. Like, you can make it whatever 20% you want, but it has to be 20% and it has to be by this day.
Right. Yeah. Is it easier to get 20% of my software containers to be V6 only than 20% of my desktops?
V6 only.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Well, when you think of it that way, you can divide up and say, here's where I'm going to get to the 20% faster in some technical areas.
Right. And the other question is it's listed as an IP enabled asset. Mm-hmm. So it's like one of those questions of like, is the fastest win to go out and build a, you know, IPv6 only VDI, spin up resource and just provide, you know, NAT64, DNS64, and, you know, get a Skunkworks project off the ground that you're going to build anyway and say like, oh, that counts as my 20%. Might not be a bad effort to at least get things going because you're dealing with it as a greenfield V6 only build environment versus trying to convert a V4 only to a V6 only. I could see that as like, I don't know, Nick, I think that's a heavier lift than just trying to go out and build something V6 only from the start. I don't know what your feeling is on that one.
You know, I've done both ways. I found that it's harder to change something that's already moving than it is to build something new and move people over to it.
Yeah, that's what my feeling is too. Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know, Scott, you've been through the same thing. I think you.
Yeah, too, I agree. Right? Greenfield's always easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also in most cases a unicorn. who gets to greenfield things? Not very many organizations get to do that. So once in a while, maybe.
Right. But that's off to the side. So because what for one person is greenfield is for another person is just an extension of what they're already doing, right? So they can see that brownfield. So I think it's one of those funny things where it's like, the likelihood you're still going to be dealing with the same, you know, switching and layer 3 fabric that probably you were dealing with before. It just happens to be that portions of it are running V6 only, and then you're building some sort of transition mechanism. And then it gets back to, okay, what can your management platform support? And can you actually, you know, monitor all this sort of stuff? There's like a whole rabbit hole you end up going down, right? Of like, how far does this V6 only implementation impact what we do organizationally? And I think maybe that's a good thing to quickly talk about too, is what sort of changes and what sort of, you know, learning mechanisms and what sort of skill sets do people need to have in their tool belt to be successful around this sort of stuff? I mean, you've had, you know, years of sort of V6 support and experience, partially because you've been interested in it and something you wanted to do, but what's your guidance to other people who are like, you know, I haven't done this before. What am I supposed to do here? Right. I think that's going to be a big challenge for a lot of organizations that, you know, that are trying to fulfill this mandate out of this memo. Right.
Yeah. The biggest challenge really is time. It's allocating the time to actually learn it. And because it's not hard, like when I learned it was a very long time ago, and, you know, I was playing with the 3FFE six bone stuff and, you know, the Kame stack that you had to build and all that. And, you know, that I did all of that on my own time at night, you know, when I probably should have been sleeping. But not everybody has that, you know, the willingness to do that or the opportunity to do that or whatever. And I think that the driving it home that this is important and someone needs to allocate, you know, 1 or 2 hours a week to really learning it. And then they can teach everyone else, or maybe it's two folks that do that. And then once you get over the hump of realizing, like, I don't compare this to IPv4. I don't, you know, think about it or manage it like it's IPv4, because it's not. You're not going to memorize addresses unless you're, you know, some sort of a savant that can do that. You're going to rely on things like DNS for knowing what the addresses are. Like the days of memorizing, you know, 10.0.0.1, so that's my core router. Those are out the window, right? And frankly, I would assert that you probably, you know, the royal you should not have been doing that anyway. Right. That's sort of painting yourself into a corner of always being the person that gets called when something breaks. So
I think the common question, Nick, is in what network have you ever worked in that DNS being down is an acceptable thing? that's an operational network, right?
Yeah.
It's great that you can memorize the address, but, you know, no one else can do anything.
There's a saying that we always used to mutter, which is, and I think you've had him on before too, Kevin Myers, and I always say this, it's always MTU unless it's DNS. And that, I mean, it should be a t-shirt for t-shirt, network engineers, yeah. Because if DNS is broken, the network is functionally down in most cases.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I don't know how people think that having an operational network and not having DNS working can go hand in hand. That's just not even, it's not rational to me in any way. And while I get network engineers like to hug their addresses, the reality is that, you know, you've done enough V6 deployments, you know this too. Once you get your prefix down and you have an orderly address plan that hopefully someone like Tom has helped you build, you know, or you take his advice out of his book, you're going to have a good structure plan. You can actually, assuming that you're not doing, you know, crazy UI64 or random addresses for your networking devices, you can actually have a reasonable plan and actually know where you're going hop to hop.
Yeah. Right. And I push back just a little bit on that, just to say, just you made a good distinction, Ed, related to, you know, it is entirely possible and it should be the case that you build an address plan that allows you to have some like immediate mental command of where your prefixes live. Yeah. But that's very mm-hmm. different than a 32 character IPv6 address to a host or an endpoint that you know, yeah, it's just exactly. For, you know, as far as like trying to memorize that. Yeah, that's a fool's plan.
Yep. Exactly. And one of the things that I'm going to go off on a tangent here just for real quick second. My experience has been that, and you guys may disagree with me on this, but it has bitten me every single time I've ever done it. Don't try to map your V6 into V4 because it will devolve eventually as it grows organically.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. We couldn't agree more. Either direction. You don't need, I think, and you know, Tom has pointed that out time and time again, is why are you going to handcuff yourself starting off on a new architecture project by adopting your V4 into your V6 or the reverse, trying to wedge your V6 plan into anything that's going on with V4? It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and to back up to the earlier point about Greenfield, like here we are at IPv6 Buzz, shattering your illusions of actually having a Greenfield opportunity since like 2018 or whatever it is since we've been doing this. But it is... When you're talking about an address plan and you're talking about, that's like one area where it is abstract enough that it is truly greenfield if you want it to be in 99% of the cases. And so, yeah, absolutely. Like how exciting to be able to build an address plan from scratch and have all of the organization built around what makes sense as opposed to having this vestigial appendage of your V4 address plan that, you know, nobody knows where anything is. There's like multiple locations, multiple sources of truth that you're trying to extract to figure out, you know, where stuff lives and how it's been allocated. And even when you think you've got it all run down, you find some corner of the network where there's, you know, another block that's been allocated that's, you know, so yeah, it's just like all of that, just you set it aside and start from scratch with V6 and you can do that. And it's wonderful.
So you mentioned source of truth here and management systems, and I wanted to speak to that briefly because that's something that has been a constant source of problems. It was problematic every time I've seen it because there's often legacy systems that don't have any clue how to stuff IPv6 addresses into them in their databases. They don't understand, you know, the colon is an escape character, whatever, right? And that's been a often unforeseen point of extra effort. So if I have, you know, a random IPAM or a, you know, in-house written telecommunications database or something like that, retrofitting these legacy systems with V6 often is a significantly larger undertaking than just building V6 or V6 only into your network because they were built, you know, 20 years ago by some person that hasn't worked there for 15 years and they don't, you know, there's no source code. This is very common.
Yeah. And I think it's that legacy of we still run Perl scripts to do certain things. And, you know, we've got some sort of cron job that does that and it takes care of this thing and it has zero idea about IPv6 at all. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. And I used to work with a guy, a brilliant developer that has, you know, we have lots of little sayings, right? And he would always say that everything everywhere is reliant on a Perl script running on a system. So it's like one Perl script controls everything. That's probably starting to migrate over to Python at this point, but I'm, you know, showing my vintage with the talk of Perl.
Yeah, Perl running on a SunOS box somewhere stuffed in the network.
Yep. You got to trace the cable to find it.
That's right.
Because it was a sheetrock tin.
Yeah. Yep. It's probably still running. That's
right. Still running. Until the hard drive finally gives away. That's what ends up giving up the ghost on those old machines is that the platter just finally just goes. But outside of that, those things would run forever.
Yeah. Yeah. You're hearing the disk fail through the wall. Is that what you're saying?
You're like, oh, we've got a rat infestation problem. No, it's a sun system.
It's like an Edgar Allan Poe story.
Oh, too funny.
Rattle, well, I mean, rattle, rattle behind the chamber door.
Yeah, it's that Alta system sitting out there. It's a great point in terms of dealing and sort of noodling through that. I mean, what are the other sort of caveats that you've sort of noticed around doing V6 only that you know folks are going to find that are going to crop up on their list pretty quickly? I mean, obviously the Perl Python issue and scripts and supporting that sort of stuff is one bucket. What's some of the other, you know, sort of technical challenges and buckets that folks are going to run into?
Yeah, for sure. So one of them sort of directly related to that is hard coding of IPv4 addresses into custom written scripts. So that kind of falls under this category we were talking about before. The other one is for V6 only, if you have even one device that won't do IPv6, you have to plumb essentially a full implementation of IPv4 all the way through your network to that host. So in a sense, it's almost like I've likened it to an infection, right? That just goes all the way down to the bone. When you've got a sensor or an instrument or some random software package that just doesn't understand V6, it has to have IPv4 and it's critical for the business or the institution. You cannot excise V4 out of your network. You have to plumb a full implementation all the way through to wherever that is from your service provider or your network provider or your network connector, all the way through your security, your border routers, your security appliances, your internal routers, and at layer two down to the, you know, it doesn't matter at layer two, but you have to give it access. And so when you have that, it is functionally impossible to completely remove IPv6. And shamefully, I was a bit caught by surprise by that because, you know, being fairly optimistic, I was like, oh, we can just turn it all off and everything's going to work, right? And, you know, stupid. That's never the case, right? I should have known better, being as old as I am and having done this as long as I have. But, you know, internal optimism, we can just do this. Well, no, we can't. And so we have to retain dual stack through a major part of a network because I can't turn V4 off at this point.
Well, let's pivot around that. So have you seen any solutions around, you know, V4 as a service where you're building an overlay so you can keep the majority of your backbone, maybe, you know, your spine to leaf and at the leaf edge, right? Enable V4 as an overlay service. So a VXLAN, EVPN, you know, sort of design methodology or something of that nature that would allow you to sort of think that way. And I know this is bleeding edge at this point talking about that, but I think that's where, at least, you know, that's where my itch is sort of inclined to go, is sort of like saying, hey, you know, that to me makes way more sense because then I can keep things sort of single protocol, except for at the very edge where I need some V4.
So I don't think that's as fringe as you think it is. I'm a very, very firm believer that V4 as a service is the next step.
Okay.
Because there's really no other way to do it. You know, it's as much as we want to, you know, the internet as a whole will not be V6 only. It just isn't going to be that for probably the duration of our careers. Right? There's always going to be somebody and somewhere that's got money that is willing to forego V6 and say, I have to have IPv4 and I have this, you know, bucket of money that I'm willing to give you to give it to me. And it's going to have to be transported somehow. And if that underlying network is V6 only, the only way you can do it is V4 as a service, an overlay or a tunnel or however you want to label it. I think that's really the only way forward. And I do foresee that being, here's what I think is going to happen. I'm going to do my personal prediction here. It is going to be service providers are going to move their cores over to v6 only in order to facilitate, you know, anyone to work with the federal networks or that just want to do v6 but keep their v4. They will create an overlay that is v4 as a service that they will potentially charge money for because it's this extra thing that they have to manage. Maybe they won't to begin with. And then as it gets less and less popular, they start because they don't want to do it anymore. And then they eventually don't. But I think that that's probably the path forward. I had another point and I forgot. but I think that I think the V4 as a service, as an overlay is really it's the only path forward to getting, a large V6 deployment everywhere.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely true. I just don't know where it's at maturity wise in terms of adoption is sort of what I meant in terms of capabilities to be able to support it and how widely it's adopted by those. I mean, the carriers are obviously doing it. I mean, if you're a mobile provider, this is just your reality today. Right. So I don't think that's anything new. But I think for enterprises and for federal government organizations, this is probably a very new concept in terms of, you know, sort of thinking about transitioning over and how that's going to work. I mean, this, like you said, it's going to be a long tail for V4 sticking around. I think it's going to be a hard climb for V6, but this OMB mandate for V6 only is really going to change some of the landscape for how people need to think about it. And, you know, when you come down to it, I mean, Scott's pointed this out time and time on the show, running two protocols is far worse, a lot more administrative headache and nightmare than getting on a single protocol and working and operating that way.
Definitely.
Yeah. And maybe
that's actually called out in the document. The reason for this document is to simplify management and reduce to one protocol so they don't have to support more than one. And you all are old enough to remember having to route AppleTalk and IPX.
Hey now. You can't call us all out here.
No, I mean, I am. I mean, I started and it was just a fact of life that IP was just another service you had to route. You know, it wasn't the most places that I started with didn't even really care that much about IP. They wanted their IPX to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I was the same. IPX, you can cut your teeth on that and AppleTalk for sure. And, you know, and I think Scott took his CCIE. He still had to do all that stuff.
Yeah, it was definitely in when I was studying.
Yeah. Apple Talk permit partial zones. I still have post-traumatic stress flashbacks about that lab.
Well,
because back then there were, you know, in 99, that was a long time ago when I took the lab, there was a bug in Cisco's code. And I don't think I had my ACLs right, but in the lab, they reboot your routers before they do your test. And grade you. And I think when they rebooted, it fixed some bug. And then I think because I got full credit, I got a really high grade. And I thought, oh my God, I'm sure I lost points on Apple. But I think a bug and a reboot actually helped me get it working. And I scored full points on that.
You can't be admitting that now. You're going to get moved to emeritus status without wanting it. No, I'm just kidding.
Their software.
Serendipitous success is always welcome.
I count that as a win.
it's always the opposite for everyone else. It's like the bug is, it bites you in the butt, not you get the bug dividend.
Well, I think the other interesting part, right, is, and this is back in the day, you know, you're running EIGRP because it supported multiple protocols.
Oh, yeah. Right?
From an address family standpoint, it was like, okay, I can run IPX, I can run, you know, AppleTalk, I can run IP and have those things sort of thinking that way. And it's, I will say, I mean, maybe, Nick, this is something that, you know, the younger network engineers are sort of getting used to, like, oh my gosh, I'm running multiple protocols at the same time. That's a new experience, and getting used to the whole thought and idea that I'm running, you know, it's really, you know, ships in the night. They're passing by each other. There are weird areas where they have dependencies upon each other, and there are other areas where they're completely independent of each other. And learning those nuances, I think, are going to be a hard set of lessons for a whole slew of people in terms of, like, you know, single address family, multiple address family sort of scenarios. I'm assuming that has bitten you in the past in your experience with
these. You're right, Ed. EIGRP was the first multi-address family routing protocol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, so what do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole generation of engineers that have two things that none of us really had the luxury of having. The first one is, we'll call one of them's not a luxury. And I have a bit of an indignant rant about these, but I won't go quite that far. You know, that running multiple protocols was just a fact of employment when most of us got started. And so that's lost, right? There's a whole generation of engineers that have never had to do that. And so it's a learned trait that sadly wasn't passed on. And so now it's a bit of a scramble to go back and figure that out. And the other one, which is definitely an indignant rant on my part, is that the expectation of address translation in the network at least one location has become a de facto standard in most engineers' eyes. Like, oh, this is where the NAT happens. And that's something that has to be unlearned, because V6, I mean, there are ways you can do it, although, you know, they kind of make me cringe a little bit to even think about. You know, it restores the proper operation of the internet, which is end-to-end connectivity. So there's this shift of thinking that will need to happen, that, oh, my address translation isn't there anymore. And that will come with a harsh realization that NAT is not security. It is a translation mechanism. And now you have to go through and figure out your security strategy around another protocol that has true end-to-end connectivity. And that, I think, that will be harder than the other.
Yeah. It's like, oh, here's where the NAT takes place. Oh, and it's here, and it's in our cloud. And it's, oh yeah, and I forgot, there's a NAT over here, and we have a NAT here, we have a NAT here. There's many NATs. It's not just one.
Well, and it'll be scary at first, but then for most engineers that are, you know, technical enough to grasp it, they'll realize that now I don't have to worry about a state table in the same way. I mean, I'm still going to have a middle box that's probably got stateful filtering, but I don't have to track these port address translations anymore. That is a complexity that will slowly sort of wither away over, you know, probably the next 15 years or so, because address translation, it won't be as important, because most things will just be V6.
Yeah. Network engineers, draw a NAT diagram. Draw a picture of your network and where all the NATs and PATs are. That would be an interesting exercise.
Well, and it demonstrates the brittleness. That to me, NAT is, I always make that correlation to, it's brittle. It prevents me from being able to have the flexibility that routing actually provides, right? And you lose that sort of, that capability of what native routing really, really gives you, because you've introduced a brittle point within your network for that state to be carried, and everything must go in and out of that location in order to keep things symmetric and in the right way. And you sort of lose that flexibility that the routing protocols are going to give you in the first place. Although maybe that's all going away with SDN anyway. So
yeah, every one of those NATs could be a single point of failure, could be a choke point, could be a place where you have to think about HA and sharing state among HA devices. You have to log stuff. Troubleshooting's a nightmare.
I'll tell you, in my experience, having done some red team pen testing stuff in the previous life, one of the first three things that I always try to do when doing such a thing is to run out the state tables.
Right.
Like, if I can cause a DOS based on running out a state table, then something is not right. It's not always about getting in. Sometimes it's about preventing access, and that's a very easy target. So I have asserted many times that port address translation in particular is actually a security risk.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is too, is if you're testing the vulnerability of the machine to be able to, roll over, and what does it do when it thinks a session state should or should not be open, right? And so there's probably a lot of use cases where you can get it to, maybe allow a session that shouldn't be, simply because you're overflowing it too, right? So it's like, oh, well, that must have existed in the past, so therefore I should let that one through. There's definitely things that can be exploited that way. I suppose that's true for V6 too, though, because if you're in a pure routed net, I mean, then it's just a matter of overflowing the pipes themselves. But maybe that's a bigger structural challenge than just overwhelming a state table in a NAT device, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit harder. I mean, if you have access to a Bitcannon, sure, you know, yeah, you can run the, you can, you know, that's just a typical DDoS that most you know, the residential ISPs are going to see every day. But
right, and hopefully they can trace those back to sourcing problems a little bit easier than someone who's trying to overflow your. It's probably pretty hard to tell who's causing havoc with your NAT device versus just trying to fill your pipe up, right?
Yeah, it's all about instrumentation, which, you know, in the V6 world is pretty solved. You know, there's IPv6 tools for managing all of the analytics pieces that you can think of. You know, there are networks that I've touched that have done all of their SNMP management over IPv6 for 15 years. Yeah, they're dual stacked, but pretty much all of the login, you know, to the loopbacks, you know, for the SSH in to make changes or whatever, and then the SNMP polling, that is all IPv6 and IPv6 only for that matter. So the, you know, those tools are there. You know, Flow Data has, you know, IPFix, NetFlow V9, SFlow all do IPv6 from an analytics perspective, and they have forever. So you can do collectors, and there's lots of commercial options out there for those tools that are, they're agnostic. You know, if you give them V4, if you give them V6, they don't really care because they can handle either one or both.
Yeah, cool. Well, I think we covered a pretty wide swath of items, you know, and down to that. And we should, you know, encourage folks, you know, you need to start thinking about your V6 only journey, especially if you're working the federal government side. It's going to be a requirement here for you soon. And any last bits of wisdom you want to impart to folks around their thought process there?
Yeah, I mean, just get started. It's, you know, you may have to allocate your own time to begin with, but it's pretty fun, to be honest, you know. And, you know, you should make requests of your employers. Say, look, this is something that we're going to need to investigate anyway. Give me an hour or two a week and, an extra machine or something so that I can go through and I can start figuring these things out. There's a lot of resources out there. This podcast in particular is very useful in identifying a lot of the little nuances, and it's fun to listen to. And then you've got things like the Hurricane Electric Tunnel Broker certification program, where if you go through the whole thing, you get a t-shirt. That's one of the first things I did when it was available, was go through. I just sat down one night and just did the whole thing. Or might have been over two nights, but you know, then I got a t-shirt that I wore so many times it fell apart. I was pretty proud of that, you know. There's a lot of resources out there for getting started, and it's, you know, it's pretty easy to just kind of spin it up, poke around at it. Your network's almost certainly got link local IPv6 already on it, so just start looking around.
Yep, be curious. Well, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. Thanks to today's guest, Nick. You know, wonderful to have you on, because we've spoken in the past. And hey, I mean, how can the audience follow you on the internet? What's the best way to sort of get in touch with you? And you have your own podcast too, so let's give a shout out to that.
Yeah, so we just sort of spun up a new, it's a continuation of an older podcast. We're calling it The Modem Show. You can check out the retro chic website, modem.show, for any more of the details on there. And I'm on Twitter at Forwarding Plane. I've got a blog. It's forwardingplane.net. So I'm around.
Yeah. It's great stuff. You always post and have great conversations. So really appreciate you coming on the show here. So
absolutely.
Yeah, this is good fun chatting. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter. We're at IPv6 Buzz. And you can hit up each one of us. Tom is at IPv6 Tom. Scott is at Scott Hoag. And I'm at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes. Hopefully you're listening on Spotify too. And if you like the podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break Podcast, plus, you know, all the other great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.